This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Meet the Frugalwoods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living by Elizabeth Willard Thames. Performed by Anne-Marie Gideon. Introduction. As I write this, I'm sitting on the back porch of the rural Vermont homestead I share with my husband and our daughter, gazing out on the 66 acres of forest, fruit trees, gardens, ponds, and streams that we feel incredibly lucky to call our own. Just a few years ago, this seemed like an impossible feat. My husband and I were struggling to conceive a baby and attempting to chart a path out of our frenzied 9-to-5 grind in urban Cambridge, Massachusetts. We wanted to achieve financial independence, quit the cubicle jobs that made us so unhappy, and create a simpler life of purpose in a rural setting. This is the story of how we brought that dream to fruition before our 33rd birthdays. My husband Nate and I are not exceptional people. We're not rich or famous or geniuses or even particularly good-looking, although we have our moments. We're just some average middle-class kids from the Midwest who decided we wanted something more out of life than what our consumer culture sells us. We realized we couldn't buy our way to happiness, and that we had to restructure how we lived, what we spent our money on, and how we used our time in order to achieve deep fulfillment and lasting contentment. I've heard people say things along the lines of, anyone can achieve financial independence, and people are poor because they don't work hard enough, and my success stems entirely from my own efforts. And I disagree with all of those sentiments. While it's true that Nate and I are average people, and we've never won the lottery, or had investment banker salaries, or been the beneficiaries of inheritances or trust funds, I'm keenly aware that we are also extraordinarily privileged. Poverty is a pervasive issue, not only in our country, but globally, and it's myopic to presume that everyone who is poor doesn't work hard enough or isn't motivated enough. It's often quite the contrary. Many people who live at or below the poverty line work much harder than I ever have or probably ever will. Working 2 and 3 jobs in an effort to simply pay rent and buy groceries and send their kids to school in shoes that fit is the punishing reality for many people. Frugality is often already a requirement for those at the lowest end of the economic spectrum, and there's simply not enough money coming in every month to save enough to create a stable financial base, let alone an emergency fund or retirement savings or investments. In order to save large amounts of money, you have to have a sufficient amount of money coming in. You can't frugalize income you don't earn. Without an emergency fund, a savings account, or any type of financial cushion, people who live paycheck to paycheck are in a perilous position. One missed shift can equal a missed rent payment or a missed electricity bill. Compounding this problem is the fact that many economically disadvantaged people lack a bank account, which means they're unable to take advantage of the lending opportunities or overdraft protections that a large financial services firm can provide. It's my belief that we, as a country, need a stronger social safety net for the working poor. We need comprehensive medical and dental coverage. We need welfare programs that don't strand families who earn just barely too much money to qualify for housing and food subsidies. We need to care not only for our children and our elderly, but also for adults who struggle, for any number of reasons, to cobble together a livable wage. I'm a proponent of exploring a universal basic income, as studies have demonstrated that entrusting people with money of their own often yields tremendous dividends for society as a whole. No one wins when a family has to choose between working a job or safe childcare. No one wins when the only food options in a neighborhood are unhealthy and expensive. No one wins when people are forced to use the emergency room as their primary care physician. As a nation and as a society, I believe we have a responsibility to care for those who experience the greatest need and to create viable pathways out of generational poverty. I share all of this with you because it's easy when talking about one's personal journey, which is what this book is, to extrapolate and make the assumption that if only everyone did as we did, then they too would experience success. But that's not the case. It's naive, presumptuous, and grossly lacking in empathy to assume as much. In many ways, My privilege and my husband's privilege took root in our lives long before we were even born. Both of our parents had college educations, had good careers, owned homes, and were in happy, financially stable marriages before we were even conceived. These factors all combined to mean that by the time we were born, Nate and I were already several steps ahead of many of the other babies in the hospital that day. Adding to the circumstances of our families is the fact that we were born into safe, middle-class neighborhoods in the United States and thus were the beneficiaries of excellent medical care, superb public schools, plenty of nutritious foods, vibrant public library systems, summer camps, girl/boy scout troops, church communities, horseback riding lessons, ballet classes, basketball teams, and much more. All of these privileges wove themselves together to form the basis for happy, warm, well-educated, well-cared-for childhoods. We didn't suffer traumas as children. We didn't endure domestic violence. We never experienced food insecurity. We were never homeless. Our electricity and water were never turned off. We were never evicted. We weren't exposed to parental drug use or addiction. Rather, we were encouraged, taught to read at home, taken on family trips to art museums and the symphony, shown how to cook and clean, disciplined with fair but firm methodology, taught to play nicely with our siblings, given pets to care for, and above all, loved unconditionally. These factors are profound in charting a person's course through life, and all of these benefits of our upbringings contributed in large part to the successes we've enjoyed as adults. And our privilege doesn't stop there. My husband and I are both white and heterosexual. I wish I didn't have to include these two facts as privileges, because I believe that people of all races, religions, genders, ethnicities, backgrounds, and sexual orientations should be treated equally. Sadly, however, that isn't the case in our country, and so I have to include these as factors integral to our successes. I wasn't subjected to individual or institutional biases in my applications for college, for graduate school, or for jobs. I was able to succeed in both academics and my career without the strain of racism or homophobia or any number of other prejudices. While I do think there are elements of my journey through extreme frugality that could be useful to anyone, I also realize that my frugality is elective. I don't have to save as much money as I do. I'm not pinching pennies in order to eat. I'm not a missed paycheck away from bankruptcy. I choose to be frugal, and I choose to live a lifestyle that has granted me financial independence. But it's no more due to my own aptitude than the fact that I can read and write. Sure, I had to work hard to learn to read and write, but I also had parents and teachers helping me out at every turn. I wish I could say that if everyone followed my advice, they too could reach financial independence. But that's simply not the case. There are too many layers of institutional privilege enabling my story for it to be replicable for everyone. There are many people who transcend difficult childhoods to achieve at the highest levels. Who you will grow up to be isn't imprinted at birth or predetermined by who your parents are. But it's undeniable that the road was easier for me. I didn't have to overcome anything in order to get where I am today. A memoir can only honestly represent a person's lived experiences, which is why I felt it was important to share all of the ways in which privilege courses through my life. I wrote this book to tell the story of how Nate and I did the unexpected, of how we broke free. I also want to encourage you to ask yourself the questions that guided our journey. What would you do if you didn't need your paycheck? What's your passion in life? And what's stopping you from making that a reality? I fully recognize that having the ability to even ask ourselves these questions is profoundly privileged. For many people, questions like these are wholly out of reach and divorced from their daily slog of trying to make ends meet. What are you doing that you love, that you hate? How do you use your time and money? And how do you wish you used your time and money? Bringing your hopes into alignment with your actions is my boldest edict. Too often, we're slotted into predetermined roles by societal expectations, family pressures, and in my case, our own internal conception of what our lives should look like. When we're able to stop the cycle of impressing others and spending money in an effort to assuage the frustrations we feel, true liberation can take hold in our lives. Identifying whether every dollar we spend is for a need or a want enables us to craft a life that's focused on living out our priorities, not the priorities of anyone else or of society at large, but the priorities that matter most to us. In the pages that follow, I hope you find inspiration and motivation to pursue your best life. 1. College grad seeks meaningful, gainful employment. Fails. I needed a job because I needed money to pay rent, a position most people find themselves in at some point in time. More than that, I wanted to climb onto what I saw as the first rung of adulthood. A career track job that you got business cards for and had to wear a suit to. I wanted to be taken seriously. I was obsessed with doing what I thought I should do because, up to this point, it had worked out pretty well for me. Sitting on a molded plastic chair in the temp agency office, I took the first job they offered me, working in a single-story beige warehouse Monday through Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., preparing documents for digitization. This wasn't anywhere near what I'd envisioned, and I was pretty sure I didn't need to wear a suit. But I also didn't want to waste time waiting for someone to call me back about my apparently worthless resume. If nothing else was going to pan out for me, I figured I might as well earn some money. It was June 2006, and I was 22 years old. I'd graduated with honors from the University of Kansas the month before, feeling flush with accomplishment. Since my freshman year of high school, that had been my goal, and I'd assumed that was all I needed to do in order to ensure lifelong success. The formula for life, as I understood it, was you go to college, you get good grades, you graduate, you get a good job, and you live happily ever after, right? Somehow that wasn't working out. I was a rule follower, a syllabus and spreadsheet lover, but now I was adrift without a rubric. I'd written what I thought was a very nice resume and cover letter and sent it in response to no fewer than 53 different job openings located all over the country at nonprofits, ranging from art museums to soup kitchens, all of which I figured would welcome a liberal arts major like myself with open arms. Not a single one called me back, or emailed me back, or even let me know they'd so much as received my application. I was throwing myself against the doors of adulthood, equipped with everything I'd been taught to bring to this stage of life, and no one was answering. Every day I worked at that beige one-story warehouse was a carbon copy of the day before. I opened a dusty green, legal-sized file folder, took out the top piece of paper, and pressed it down on the table under my palms, spreading from the center outward, my hands flattening each corner as I went. Next, I checked for staples, which I'd remove like unwanted teeth with a sadistic rip from the metal jaws of my staple remover, heedless of the gaping maw left in its wake. I peeled off post-it notes, so old they barely posted anymore, and taped them down on all four sides to a blank piece of paper I'd whisk up with my rubber-covered fingertip from a stack in the center of the table. I'd then pick up the second piece of paper from the folder and begin afresh, as if for the first time, until I'd performed this ritual on every single piece of paper in the folder. Then I'd move on to the next folder in my inbox. I sat on a metal folding chair at a plastic folding table with two other women in this windowless, cavernous warehouse. I was just 5 miles from where I'd blissfully spent the past 4 years double majoring in political science and creative writing, which I'd assumed would somehow alchemize into a profession. I'd never quite identified what that profession might be, but I figured that applying for jobs would be like applying for college. Line up all the correct paperwork, check all the right boxes, and get accepted. That's adulthood, right? The warehouse had gray-painted concrete walls, and I couldn't figure out why you'd bother to paint concrete gray. Something I had plenty of time to mull over because there was no variation to my days. No additional tasks, nothing to do but get a box of files every morning and sit at my table for 8 hours straightening edges. The two women who worked alongside me were nice enough, and we'd chat as we worked, or I'd listen to NPR on my headphones. I was sinking into depression, and what I can honestly say was ennui. Was this why I'd gotten a BA? Why I'd pulled all-nighters for 4 years to eke out a 4.0? I felt like I was spiraling downward into an abyss that would terminate with me living in my parents' basement, which wasn't even finished, and babysitting their neighbors' kids. See? Ennui. To me, at 22, that sounded like about the worst thing that could happen to a person. I hadn't even lived at my parents' house during summers since my freshman year. I wanted, more than anything, to be an independent person. A person who could find a job. Adding to my embarrassment and frustration over my failure to launch was the fact that my closest confidant, my boyfriend, Nate, was hired for a real job. A job with a salary that one might list on a resume and that one wouldn't be mortified to admit one did, before we even graduated. I'd been a better student than Nate, with more A's and more extracurriculars, so I seethed with jealousy. He had an internship all of our senior year, which he'd spent more time at than he had studying, and then they'd offered him a full-time position. My internship at the City Arts Center, conversely, had not translated into a job, even though I'd applied for their entry-level administrative assistant position. I'd spent more time studying, a strategy I was starting to question now that I was so raw with envy as I toiled in a warehouse at a plastic folding table. I felt duped. No one had warned me about this postgraduate purgatory of being educated but inexperienced and unqualified to do, well, really anything. Sitting in my 1990 light blue Toyota Camry station wagon in the parking lot of the document scanning warehouse in late July, I had my cell phone clamped to my ear, and I thought I was going to sweat to death. The air conditioning in the car, which I'd paid cash for myself at age 16 with money saved up for my babysitting and church receptionist gigs, didn't work. The only way to stay cool was to run the fan on the highest setting. But the problem was that between the engine and the fan, I couldn't hear my potential future boss on the line, sitting as she was in her office on the 26th floor of a building in Midtown Manhattan, which I imagined to be sleek, snowy white, and generously air-conditioned. I'd had the car door open to allow in some hot Kansas breeze, but then I could hear my colleagues who were also on break chatting and laughing from the warehouse steps, oblivious to my potential life-changing phone conversation over here. I waved to them so that if I passed out and didn't come back into work, someone would find me before I roasted. I wedged a notebook between the steering wheel and my stomach and tried to take notes without smearing the ink with my sweat. I made a mental note to sit on the passenger side for any and all future phone interviews. This was my third call with AmeriCorps, and it sounded like they might be as desperate to hire someone as I was to be hired. Nate's job was in Kansas City, so I'd started my search there, thinking we could live together. Although, in all honesty, I wasn't thinking we'd just live together. I was thinking we'd get engaged and then live together. I wanted everything adult-like to happen immediately. Career, marriage, kids, house, and a dog, too, come to think of it. I brought this up with Nate in what I considered a casual, wondering what you're thinking about us and marriage sort of way, which always seems to come off as aggressive and gauche when I try to do it. Due to my enduring lack of suavity, Nate knew exactly what I was driving at and flat out told me he didn't want to get engaged until after we'd had some time in the real world. Some experience beyond our collegiate bubble that provided everything we needed. Structure, purpose, a social life, beer. In retaliation for his mature cool-headedness, I veered my job search to the East Coast, since that seemed like a good way to show Nate how miserable his life would be without me. After 2 months of fruitless searching, I came across AmeriCorps, which didn't pay a salary per se, but which did provide what seemed like worthy resume fodder. At the very least, I figured it was several steps up from document-scanning doom in a warehouse in suburban Kansas, which is a pretty low bar to step over. Turns out, AmeriCorps wanted me. Offer letter in hand, I quit my document-scanning gig in what I imagined to be a triumphant flourish, although no one seemed to notice. It was late August, and I retreated to my parents' two-story brick subdivision home in suburban, far suburban, St. Louis, Missouri, to prepare for my decampment to the exotic-sounding New York City. Later that week, I stood in the fluorescent-lit dressing room of the JCPenney at the West County Mall, wearing a size 4, shoulder-padded, gray plaid skirt suit with pink piping and a pink top peeking out from underneath the jacket. My mom said it looked very professional, and since she and my dad offered to buy me, in her words, a career wardrobe as a graduation present, I agreed. This was a job in an office, after all, which I assumed meant wearing a suit and nylons every day. Equipped with 5 suits and 2 pairs of the only low heels that fit me, naturalizer pumps, a brand patronized primarily by women my mother's age, unengaged and having never set long, narrow foot in New York City before in all my 22 years, I got on a plane bound for LaGuardia with the maximum allowable baggage. As my taxi from the airport pulled up to a run-down, graffiti-covered, three-story walk-up in pre-gentrified Crown Heights, Brooklyn, conveniently located across the street from a blocks-long abandoned warehouse with not a single intact pane in its windows, I asked the driver to double-check the address, because there was no way this was my apartment. But he wasn't wrong. This was, according to his map and the address I'd written down, where I now lived. My roommates, two of my friends from college who also had offer letters from New York City-based jobs, had picked this place out, and to be fair, the only requirement I'd given them was cheap. I'd gotten on a plane in the suburban, safe middle class. I'd previously said bland, but bland was sounding pretty good right about now. Midwest, and landed in one of the more notorious neighborhoods of urban, intimidating, to me anyway, working-class Brooklyn. As I climbed the stairs to my apartment with my suitcases digging into my palms and slamming against my legs, I hoped Nate was missing me in a painful, longing, I should have proposed sort of way, because this had better be worth it. Unpacking didn't take much time, since there was a firm ceiling on how much I could cram into two suitcases and two carry-ons. AmeriCorps would pay me $10,000 for the year, and I had a few hundred dollars in the bank that I'd saved up from my various college jobs as a writing tutor, a money counter at the Six Flags theme park, a hostess at the Olive Garden, a receptionist at a car dealership, and a camp counselor. AmeriCorps tactfully referred to my $10,000, an amount too small to legally be called a salary, as a service stipend. The idea behind AmeriCorps is that youths, like me, work at small nonprofits in impoverished communities for a year and in return gain valuable job experience. I would sound much more altruistic if I said I chose AmeriCorps because I wanted to give back, and that was part of it, but more crucially, nowhere else would hire me. I was determined to live on this $10,000 stipend because I didn't have any debt whatsoever. My parents helped me pay for college, plus I'd had scholarships, plus I'd worked, plus KU was very cheap, and I wasn't about to take on debt in this first test of adulthood. Given this budget, there was no way I could afford furniture. So I decided to build it out of cardboard boxes. Not furniture that came packed in cardboard boxes, but out of the cardboard itself. I cut banana boxes, stacked them, and taped them together to make a sort of dresser with open shelves. Next, I turned a box upside down and put a sheet over it as a tablecloth. Voila! A bedside table. I rolled out my yoga mat on the floor of my windowless bedroom and covered it with the pillow and blanket I'd stuffed into one of my suitcases. I was triumphant. I felt industrious and independent, like a modern-day Virginia Woolf striking out on my own, unbeholden to parents or boyfriend for funds, and able to craft a room of one's own from cardboard. I figured if I could make my own free furniture, I could probably hack it as an adult. I'll admit that the yoga mat as bed did get old after a week, so I saved up to buy the cheapest mattress, plus delivery, that I could find at the Atlantic Center Mall in Brooklyn. There were limits to my thriftiness. I bought a map of the world shower curtain because I hate wasting time and figured that bathing and brushing teeth could be made into multitasking opportunities to enhance one's knowledge of geography. That is how I learned that the Seychelles are a thing. So clearly, I needed this map. And with that, I was moved in. Walking down Franklin Avenue, my new street, I saw the ornate architecture underlying now derelict buildings. I could tell that these had once been elegant brick-front row houses with curling spirals of wrought iron, expansive front steps, and square, tidy gardens out front. Now, they were chopped into warren-like apartments, fronted by patches of dirt littered with cans, newspapers, broken glass, and cigarette butts. There was an empty lot a block up from my apartment, choked with weeds and bags of garbage. Laundromats, bodegas, an off-brand dollar store, hair salons, storefront churches, and payday loan businesses were what the neighborhood offered. Graffiti coated everything, even the metal grates that shop owners pulled down to protect their glass storefronts every night. There were no restaurants or banks or gyms or coffee shops or clothing stores or grocery stores or doctor's offices. But there were people everywhere. Out on stoops, chatting, calling to one another, laughing, scolding kids who ran around barefoot, seemingly oblivious to the broken glass and trash. People pushed rattling shopping carts full of cans and bottles down the center of the street, destined for the promise of 5-cent returns at the neighborhood recycling center. The Franklin Avenue subway stop, which boasted both the 2-3 and 4-5 trains, was 8 blocks from my apartment. I hustled there my first morning of work. I was so tense about messing up my train route that I barely had time to register the nuances of the street I was walking down. Those realizations would come later. After parochially jabbing my subway pass at the turnstile a few times, I stood back, watched the experienced masses streaming past, and tried to mimic the way they slid their cards through the reader. They performed this ceremony so quickly that the mechanics were almost imperceptible. It took me a good 3 minutes to get through, during which time I thought the throng behind me might pick me up and throw me over the turnstile. My only experience with public transit before that morning was riding on the train that went around our zoo as a kid. I clutched my handwritten directions, this being the pre-smartphone era, in my sweaty hands, trying to keep track of which stop we were at each time the train lurched into a station. When I first got on, I positioned myself so that I was staring at the map above the door, which had Christmas tree light-sized bulbs that lit up at the appropriate station. But after 30 minutes underground, there were so many people jammed into the car that I couldn't see the map anymore and was frantically trying to make out the garbled name the conductor rattled off at each station. Everyone else seemed to know by instinct where we were. I watched it happen over and over again as people, zoning out on headphones, reading books, or flat out asleep, would animate like wind-up toys and scurry off at their stop. I decided after 45 minutes that I should be there by now, so I got out and realized that the names of the stations are on the walls outside the train windows, and that I'd gotten off a stop too early. I jumped on the next train and disembarked at the correct stop this time, Grand Central Terminal in the heart of Midtown Manhattan. Since most of the train population emptied out at Grand Central, I was now moving in the center of a pack of people, all shuffling up the stairs. I couldn't have turned around or bent down or scratched my nose without disrupting the herd of humanity I was part of. At the top of the stairs, I was spat out into Grand Central, which was the polar opposite of where I'd started my morning, with its vaulted ceilings, marble columns, and antique clocks. Investment bankers pushed past me wearing Rolex watches, and executives in red-soled Louboutins clicked around me, demonstrably annoyed that I was a stationary beacon in this otherwise constantly flowing crowd, all determined, all in a rush, all giving off a sense of purpose. Between the people and the building, I'd never seen so much wealth on display in one place. I'd also never seen so many exits in one place. From where I was standing, there appeared to be about 10, all going in different directions with indecipherable indications of where they led. The directions I'd scribbled did not include which exit to take. So, I guessed, and ended up walking in roughly the direction of my new office. It was 8:40 a.m., and I was supposed to be there by 9, so I thought my timing was perfect, because I needed to go into a lobby bathroom and change my shoes, brush my hair, apply lipstick, dab the stress sweat off my blouse, and top up on deodorant. When I got to my office building, however, I learned a universal New York City truth. There are no public restrooms in office buildings. Worse still, my boss, who turned out to be a poised, young, glamorous New Yorker, was standing in the lobby, in heels, without nylons, waiting for me. I walked into my first day of my first real job wearing tennis shoes over nylons, with matted hair, and with sweat dripping down my back underneath my pastel shoulder-padded suit that would have looked perfect on a 50-year-old Midwestern real estate agent trying to sell a suburban split level with green carpeting and a porch she insisted on referring to as the Lanai. 2. My year of food stamps and billionaires. I never thought about money a whole lot before moving to New York City. At least not in the how am I going to afford to eat sort of way. My parents aren't wealthy, but they've always owned their own home and packed school lunches with carrots and whole wheat sandwiches for their three kids. When I was 12, we went to Washington, D.C., because my dad had a conference there and the hotel room was paid for by his work. We visited all of the free Smithsonian museums, and I ate a Reuben sandwich for the first time at a restaurant near the theater where Lincoln was shot. I had no first-hand frames of reference for the outlandish wealth or the desperate poverty that New York City encompasses. Growing up, my family and I volunteered regularly at soup kitchens and donated to homeless shelters, but there's a remove when you drive an hour home afterward to the scrubbed, mono-economic suburbs. I knew intellectually that a vast chasm exists between rich and poor, but I hadn't encountered an academic or journalistic rendering of the divide that adequately conveyed the visceral feelings of experiencing it for myself. Turns out, AmeriCorps was my year of economic extremes, my year of food stamps and of billionaires. A doorman in a matching burgundy cap, jacket, and pants with gold piping and white gloves flung open the door for my boss, Sarah, and me, and then ushered us through the marble Rococo-inspired lobby with gold-leaf fleur-de-lis on the walls. "We're here to see Marcy," my boss told him as he escorted us to the elevator where he pressed the button marked 18. No last name needed. The doormen in our donors' buildings knew every one of their residents and exactly which multi-million-dollar apartment they inhabited. I was a development associate, the second on a team of two tasked with raising money for the small nonprofit that AmeriCorps had assigned me to. When I filled out my AmeriCorps application online, there was a drop-down menu of fields to choose from, and I'd picked fundraising because my dad was a fundraiser, and I knew it involved things I thought I knew how to do, namely writing and talking to people. A woman in wash-and-wear slacks and a beige top, which, in my non-existent experience with domestic help, I would have called an art smock, opened the door to Marcy's apartment and led us down the hallway with an inlaid wood floor. Sitting on a marble-topped mahogany table with carved ballerina legs was a bouquet of white roses and pale pink peonies that was more of a centerpiece than a bouquet, and I wondered briefly if it was left over from someone's wedding. No, I quickly realized, it was just a foyer bouquet, which coordinated with a smaller but no less opulent arrangement on top of the grand piano in the living room, where Marcy stood poised for our arrival. She glided across an expanse of white carpeting to embrace Sarah and kiss her on both cheeks. I was trying to figure out who the nameless woman in the smock was, and found my answer when she silently carried in a tray of tea sandwiches. I then understood that we wouldn't be introduced. Everything in Marcy's home was precise and immaculate, and by contrast, I felt elephantine. I stood frozen in place on the pristine white carpeting as I inclined my head toward Marcy so that she could kiss my cheeks, too. I hadn't washed my hair that morning and flushed with shame that she would smell my lower-class lack of hygiene. I knew Marcy and her lot didn't wash their own hair. They popped over to a dry bar for a blowout. I thought I saw her smooth, pearlescent forehead wrinkle as she rounded my face for the destination of my second cheek, her Chanel earring scratching my skin ever so slightly, leaving an indentation of, "You can't afford this," in its wake. My scalp suddenly felt greasier than the cheap cheese pizza my roommates and I scarfed on the floor of our dining room tableless living room. I swear, dandruff started to plume. The kissing ritual over, a bizarre New York City thing that I never fully understood or felt comfortable with, I turned my head to the left, pretending to look out the floor-to-ceiling window with a view of Manhattan, in order to surreptitiously check if there was any dandruff on the shoulder of what I now realized was a provincial, criminally unfashionable beige suit with thin blue stripes and pleats all the way around the hem of its knee-length skirt. Marcy and Sarah were chatting about chemical peel facials, a conversation I had nothing to contribute to. So I began to inch around the room, taking in the incongruous collection of art on the walls. As far as I could tell, the only unifying thread was that it was all real art by real artists. Our goal today was to secure a donation from Marcy, perhaps one of these paintings, for our nonprofit's annual gala fundraising auction at Christie's. Sarah also planned to ask her to consider purchasing a dinner table at the event for $25,000. This being a sum nearly three times my annual salary, I couldn't imagine she'd say yes. Even though I knew that to Marcy, $25,000 was about the equivalent of $5 to me, I still couldn't comprehend how a person could have enough excess cash to simply give away that much money. In this way, fundraising felt miraculous to me. I liked that we gave people a chance to help others, a chance to do something meaningful with their money. But I still couldn't fathom the dollar amounts, and was relieved that Sarah made the actual ask. Marcy and Sarah were helping themselves to the spread that the maid had brought in, but I hesitated, mortified I'd drop food on something priceless. I wondered if there was any way I could avoid eating without seeming weird. I couldn't feign vegetarianism or an allergy to gluten, since my boss had witnessed me wolf down a cheeseburger when we'd gone out for a team-building lunch the week before. Plus, I was starving, and not in a financial or hunger position to turn down a free lunch. So I held my breath while balancing a Limoges plate of ham sandwich on my lap, perched on the edge of a pale rose-colored damask sofa that probably cost more than my undergraduate degree. My legs and back were cramping because I had my knees jammed together and my lower back arched to keep the plate stationary while alternately smiling, saying a few conversationally appropriate words to prove I wasn't mute slash an idiot, and taking infinitesimal bites. I looked down and saw a determined run in my nylons making its way from somewhere deep inside my brown half-inch pumps up the outside of my calf. Every time I shifted, it bolted upward. My mom had taught me that if I ever accidentally broke something at another person's house, I should pay to replace it. But there was no way I could afford to even offer to replace anything in Marcy's apartment, which made me feel unwelcome in my own mind. I'd only ever been in the homes of people relatively close to my own position on the economic spectrum. People who owned things from Bed Bath & Beyond or World Market, and perhaps, on the high end, Pottery Barn, but probably purchased with a coupon or on clearance. I prayed that we'd move over to the security of the massive dining room table I could see lurking in the next room, replete with its own coordinating floral centerpiece. A plate is so much more stable on a table, so less likely to be dropped onto white carpeting. No luck. We were quite clearly staying in the living room on these unforgiving, light-colored surfaces with nowhere to rest cutlery or one's glass of lime-infused sparkling water. It occurred to me that no one who cleans their own home would have this much white-slash-nearly-white furniture. Sarah, a consummate pro, mercifully did all the talking because I wasn't sure what to say to a person who had hundreds of dollars in floral arrangements delivered to her home every few days. Marcy offered to donate a week at their vacation home in Nice, France, and to purchase a dinner table. Our work was done. That night, I was drained from maintaining a faux smile and a tenuous perch on Marcy's living room furniture all afternoon. Riding home on the train, I didn't have the energy to read the Brooklyn Public Library book I'd dragged around with me all day. I just sat there and stared at people as they got on and off the subway car. 45 minutes later, I was back home in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. There were police cars stationed at every other cross street of Franklin Avenue, and a police observation tower sitting outside of the Yaffa Money Mart bodega, three blocks up from my apartment. I walked over to a police car and asked what was going on. The officer told me they were on routine surveillance for drug and gang-related activity. I asked if I should do anything to protect myself, and he said,
"Move to a safer neighborhood."
Stunned, I walked home and locked the door. I'd seen a gun not attached to a law enforcement officer for the first time, and the inside of a billionaire's home for the first time during my first month in New York City, and the whiplash was almost unbearable. I was starting to feel like I'd made a mistake in coming here, but I couldn't back out now. I was on contract with AmeriCorps for a year, and more to the point, I well knew that nowhere else would hire me without this year of experience on my resume. So I sat in my windowless bedroom, staring at my cardboard dresser, eating black beans from a can, drinking wine from a box, and wondering how I'd survive the next 11 months. There wasn't a grocery store in my immediate neighborhood, but after a few weeks, my roommates and I found a Key Food 11 blocks away, which had cramped aisles of mostly canned and frozen goods with fly-specked fluorescent lights overhead. Despite reading about them, I'd never understood what it felt like to live in a food desert. I had $120 in food stamps every month, which was another benefit of AmeriCorps. Since my rent was $500 a month and I brought home $833.33 every month, and was trying to save as much of that $333.33 as humanly possible, I couldn't afford to spend any more than the food stamp allotment on my meals. After I figured out I could slip laundry detergent and shampoo in with my groceries and pay for them with my food stamp debit card, I spent even less on actual food. I'm a terrible, not to mention unenthusiastic cook, so I worked out a rotation of canned tuna, peanut butter, usually without bread, black beans, pasta, and frozen dinners that fit my budget of around $4 or less per day. Since my office provided a pizza lunch every Friday, I'd stuff myself and then take home all the leftovers I could squeeze into a gallon-sized Ziploc bag I'd bring from home and wash out each week. I was dizzy with excitement the hour before the pizza was delivered, steaming hot and delicious with doughy, garlicky knots as an appetizer. I'd learned about poverty in college, and food deserts specifically, but none of that effectively conveyed what it feels like to carry a week's worth of cheap groceries home, the plastic bag handles digging into my wrists, for an 11-block walk over urine-soaked sidewalks, with people asking me to give them my food, and me feeling guilty for not giving it to them because I just could not repeat the ordeal. There was a bodega on my street that sometimes had fresh fruit, so I'd buy apples or bananas on my way into work if they weren't too brown and spotted. I couldn't get over the fact that back in the Midwest, we'd considered it an actual chore to hop in our car and drive a few miles to a gigantic, sparkling, air-conditioned grocery store that played top 40 and sold every kind of vegetable you could ever want, and a lot that no one ever did seem to want. "Go back to where you came from!" a woman screamed at me as I pushed my four-wheeled metal cart to the laundromat one Saturday morning. I was walking down the sidewalk with my dirty laundry, so I thought it was pretty obvious that I, in fact, lived here. Up until that point, that moment of being yelled at in the street, I'd assumed I was struggling alongside my neighbors, that we were all poor and on food stamps and desperate together. Every week we sat side by side on the cracked orange plastic chairs in the laundromat that stank of feet and had washers encrusted with grime around the edges. We all dully watched our clothes rotate, since it was well known they'd be stolen, still dripping wet if we left. But that woman's words, and the naked anger behind them, made me realize that I was a fake. I was just trying on the mantle of poverty for a year, making a cutesy budget to mete out my food stamps and picking up loose change underneath swank Manhattan bars I'd duck into, pretending I was meeting a friend, but really just hoping someone had dropped a 20 as they ordered their third martini. I wasn't living in entrenched generational poverty with no way out, and I had no one to provide for but myself. What a selfish, entitled brat I was. I'd be gone as soon as my contract with AmeriCorps was over and my lease ended. I had no intention of living here in any permanent sense, and my neighbors knew it. They hated what I represented. White, educated, wealthy privilege. Forget my billionaire donors. I'd never understood my own privilege in such sharp relief. I hated living in Crown Heights. I hated the yelling at all hours, the gunshots, the mice and cockroaches in our apartment, and the inexplicable incident where someone ripped all the sidewalk trees out of their planters one night. But I've never been more grateful to live somewhere. Without that experience, I wouldn't have a frame of reference for how fortunate I am and for how grinding and chronic true poverty becomes. I wouldn't understand how profoundly fortunate it is to live in a neighborhood you're not terrified to walk through alone at night and that has a grocery store and banks and doctor's offices. I didn't make a conscious choice to live in Crown Heights, and at the time, all I could think about was leaving. But it was the best thing that could have happened to privileged, sheltered, 22-year-old me. I didn't belong in either the living rooms of the wealthy or my neighborhood with its en plein air drug trade. I started to despise both. I learned that I didn't want to be rich after listening to our donors complain about managing their household staffs and which apartment building they could afford to upgrade to and where they'd summer and which elite schools their children would attend. It struck me that most of these people weren't happy in a deep or genuine way. There was too much peer pressure to conform, aspire, strive, and prove their wealth to simply enjoy life. Moreover, I got the sense that if you are tremendously wealthy, you never know if people are interested in you or in your money. I also saw that some people in this echelon came to define themselves by their wealth more than by any other aspect of their lives. Exactly like my Crown Heights neighbors, some of whom were ruled by their lack of money, the affluent are sometimes ruled by its presence. I didn't want any of that. I felt as though there had to be more to life than an endless acquisition of money in order to continually buy more stuff. On the other pole of things, I didn't want to be poor, with the attendant desperation, anger, and depression. Both worlds were completely obsessed with money for opposite reasons. I realized that I wanted a life where money wasn't important. And so, in addition to my resolve not to take on debt that year, I decided to save as much as I possibly could. I had no idea if this type of life was even possible, and I knew next to nothing about managing my finances, pitiful as they were. But I figured that the place to start was with money in the bank. And so, I began to save. The upside here was that my plan vis-a-vis Nate seemed to be working. His job in Kansas was a contract position that ended in November, so he decided to look for his next employer on the East Coast. In December, he flew to New York and spent the month holed up in my windowless bedroom, job hunting on the spotty Wi-Fi we borrowed from our downstairs neighbors. But what he was more successful at, and has always had an uncanny knack for, is networking. This is how we found ourselves one Thursday night at a bar in Hell's Kitchen that served free hot dogs, and how, in true Nate fashion, he left with an interview scheduled at a firm in Boston that married his two great loves, other than me, politics and software engineering. He was hired the next week. In early January, we took the $15 Feng Hua bus up to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to find him an apartment. He settled on a subterranean basement unit with the pros of being in a desirable urban neighborhood and a 5-minute walk from his new office. We celebrated with dinner at a BYOB Indian restaurant in the East Village that, for unknown reasons, is covered with Christmas lights. It's also cheap beyond belief, two things I have to believe are co-related. Nate was gone the next week. Cambridge is a lot closer to Brooklyn than Kansas, but it's still a 217-mile distance and one of the most expensive corridors of the United States. Neither of us owned a car, so we were left with the bus. Let's iron something out right now. A city bus is fine. A city bus is cheerful with a jovial driver and passengers who have recently bathed, all zipping around town with ease. But a long-distance bus? That is an entirely different animal. A long-distance bus is no one's first choice. It's no one's second choice. It's the choice of last resort for people who cannot afford to cross state lines in any other way. Any other way, I tell you. Every Friday at exactly 5 p.m., I'd run from my Midtown office to Grand Central Terminal, banging my suitcase, a beaten-up green 80s-era hand-me-down from Nate's dad, behind me, and ride to the Lower East Side where the Feng Hua bus picked up, standing the whole way so that I could be the first person to bolt off the train and up the station steps. There wasn't a stop or a station, per se, for the Feng Hua, just a window counter jutting out of a Chinese restaurant where I bought my $15 ticket. Then, no matter the weather, I stood on the sidewalk in a glum queue of people who simultaneously wanted to get to Boston, but did not want to get on this bus with its inoperable windows and ingrained stench of fish and fried food. I'd slump into an aisle seat and try to look like I had typhoid/anger management issues, hoping no one would want to sit next to me. And no one wanted to sit next to me because we all tacitly agreed that the only thing worse than riding on a bus for 4 hours is sitting next to a stranger on a bus for 4 hours, which is what usually happened. A latecomer would rush on the bus, sweating from their jog, victorious they'd made it, and squeeze in next to me, our coats and bags jumbling at our feet and falling down on top of us from the too small overhead bin. We'd nod apologetically at each other, both knowing we prefer to sit alone, but also acquiescing to our new reality. My fellow passengers and I would eat the dinners we'd brought, not making eye contact, facing forward, futilely praying we wouldn't be delayed in the inevitable, inexorable Friday evening rush hour traffic for more than an hour or two. Once we were stuck for 7 hours on the highway in the middle of a blizzard. I've tried to think of worse experiences in my life. The only one that comes even remotely close is the time Nate and I flew to Belgium for vacation, and I contracted food poisoning in the airport and spent the entire flight running back and forth to the lavatory. The Fanghua bus service was shut down in 2013 for safety violations, but this was 2007, and they were, somehow, hurtling passengers down the highway, providing a means of transportation for everyone who couldn't afford a $200 train ticket just to get from one state to the next. At the end of this 4 to 7 hour trudge, Nate would meet me at South Station in downtown Boston, and we'd snuggle on the T-Ride to Central Square in Cambridge. The weekends were how I wanted the rest of my life to be, playing house with Nate. He was it for me. He was my future. We were too poor to do anything, so we'd melt cheese on bread in the toaster oven his parents gave him as a new job present, and drink boxed wine by the light of Christmas candles I bought for us in the Walgreens holiday clearance section. We slept late on Saturdays, and then walked the length of the city many times over, pausing to read the menus of restaurants we couldn't afford to eat in. The only reason I brought a suitcase every week was to load it up with my dirty laundry, sheets included, and wash it in his in-unit washer-slash-dryer, which was located in the front hall-slash-living room right behind the couch. Every Sunday afternoon, starting at about 3 p.m., a hollow well of despair bloomed in me. I'd watch the clock, try not to watch the clock, then watch the clock again as my time with Nate ticked down. It was the lowest point of my week, every week. Initially, I took a mid-afternoon Fanghua home, but as the months wore on and our ritual of creating a two-person nest deepened, I moved my departure time later and later. I ended up with the 7 p.m. bus, which was the latest I could possibly go and still make it to work the next morning by 9 a.m. The Fanghua dumped me in the fish-gut, drenched streets of Chinatown at 11 p.m. Then I'd take two trains back to Crown Heights and walk the 8 blocks home guided by whichever streetlights happened to be working that week, trailing my suitcase of clean laundry, nursing my weekly broken heart. In April, Sarah offered me a full-time position to begin after my AmeriCorps tenure ended in September. I was flattered, but presented with a dilemma since I didn't want to continue this Fanghua drudgery. I wanted to move in with Nate, but not without first getting engaged. I thought if I just moved in with him, we might never get married. We'd slide into cohabitation and never see the point of making it official. I'd miss out on that element of adulthood. I was so bent on following what I envisioned as the prescribed steps for achievement that I was convinced marriage had to be part of my life in order for me to be perceived as successful. Sensing this was my moment for leverage, I outlined the situation for Nate in one long, awkward sentence that went something like, "My lease is up at the end of August. I want to leave Brooklyn. I'm tired of the long-distance relationship thing, and ideally I'd move in with you, but I'm not willing to do that unless you're ready to put a ring on it." I figured if he didn't propose soon, he never would. Eons elapsed, by which I mean a month. No proposal happened, and I started what can only be correctly described as world-class stressing out. What if spending the rest of our lives together wasn't what Nate had in mind? I'd considered our marriage a foregone conclusion since the beginning of our senior year, when I'd returned from 8 months of studying abroad and he'd come to the airport with my parents after driving the 5 hours to St. Louis and staying at their house overnight without me. Us not getting married hadn't entered my calculations. I was now 23, with very little in savings, and no clear next step other than moving to Boston and getting married. I hadn't made contingency plans because none of my future casting was without Nate by my side. The job I'd been offered, that is to say, the job I had, would pay $30,000 a year, so I'd no longer have access to food stamps or a free Metro card, another AmeriCorps benefit. By my calculations, that meant I'd still be slogging through white-collar poverty. Both of my roommates had already made plans to move in with other people, and I had no clue where I'd live in New York City. I certainly didn't want to stay in Crown Heights, but I also had no prospects for roommates. All of my friends were already partnered or roommated up. I couldn't afford to live alone, and I was terrified of moving in with Craigslist strangers. I was also keenly aware of the financial ramifications of us getting married. Neither of us earned enough at that point to pay rent, buy groceries, and also save anything close to real money. The only hope I saw was for us to combine powers. Living together in Nate's tiny one-bedroom would dramatically increase our savings rate and allow us to put some distance between us and a $0 net worth. Yeah, I loved Nate and wanted to spend the rest of my life with him, but I also saw marriage as fiscally prudent. If our salaries were merged in the same bank account, we'd actually be able to shore up a decent emergency fund, a concept I'd recently learned about from my secondhand copy of Personal Finance for Dummies. I was also vaguely aware that we were supposed to be saving for retirement, a fairly ludicrous concept when you're a 23-year-old struggling to buy food, but I saw the economizing efficiencies of marriage as a way to get us closer to these desirable adult-like ends. A clammy panic wrapped its fingers around my Nate-loving heart. Nate balances out my perfectionist neuroses. Example, see above paragraph. And pushes me to be a better, more accomplished person. There's no one I'd rather spend every day of my life with. I even like going grocery shopping with him because he pretends he's a modern art critic when discussing food package labels. No one else does that. If he didn't propose, not only was it going to screw up my whole life trajectory, slash fact that I'd already made a list of baby names that sound good with Nate's last name, I also had very real logistical concerns come August 31st, 2007. In June, Nate and I took a trip to visit my parents and our college friends who still lived in our college town. On our first day in Lawrence, Kansas, Nate said he wanted to take a walk around campus. We headed out, and he took a backpack with him, which I thought was odd because he prides himself on never carrying anything, but he explained it was supposed to rain that afternoon and that he was bringing an umbrella. Nate was speed walking, and at 6'2", he has a way of getting ahead of me, so I was running to keep up. He seemed oddly sweaty, so I wondered what was up. Was this a sign that he was on drugs? Sweating, fast walking, a quick pulse, nervous eyes, and an unexplained backpack? I made a mental note to Google it later. We came to Buttig, the building on campus with the biggest lecture halls, and Nate said he wanted to go inside to use the restroom. To do drugs? I wondered. He returned a few minutes later with a janitor who unlocked one of the lecture halls for us. Nate ushered me up the steps and practically pushed me into a chair near the top of the auditorium. The lights were off in half the room, so I twisted in my seat to see where a light switch might be. When I turned around, Nate was down on one knee, my late grandmother's engagement ring in his trembling hands and his mouth moving. He was asking me something that I couldn't understand because I was crying so hard. He looked nervous and asked if these were good tears or bad tears. "Good," I managed to sputter. He slipped the ring on my finger, the wrong one, actually, but that was much more easily remedied than redrafting my entire life plan. I now understood where we were. These were the exact seats we'd sat in the first time we met in a Journalism 101 class the second semester of our freshman year. He told me later he'd read a poem he'd written about our love, but I have no memory of that. All I remember is being filled with overwhelming joy, and if I'm honest, a pretty large amount of relief. 3. The Tumblers of Adulthood. I was 23 years old with a hand-me-down diamond ring on my left hand, business cards, and a salary that was real this time, not a mere stipend. I took myself rather seriously at that point and felt like the tumblers of adulthood were clicking into place. Engagement? Click. Real job? Click. Living with Nate? Click. I was only forward-looking, always pressed into the wind, craning my neck to see what I could achieve next, what more I could cross off of my unending list. I saw the present as my platform for launching into the future, not as something with any merit of its own. There was no resting on laurels or enjoying of the moment for me. Nate and I decided to renew the lease on his basement apartment in Cambridge because it was cheap and conveniently located. We agreed we needed to save money for our future, an amorphous concept, but one which we knew would require more than the combined $8,000 we had in the bank. We wanted to be together, and we didn't care that the only sunlight in that apartment snaked through the partially subterranean windows for about an hour every afternoon. It was like trying to line up a Stonehenge equinox to catch an ephemeral ray on your bare forearm. I'd grown up hearing my parents' stories of their first home, which was a tiny two-story in Denver furnished with hand-me-down furniture for my great-uncle's dental practice waiting room. In the summers, it was so hot in their unair-conditioned bedroom that they dragged their mattress down to the cool basement, which had a concrete floor with a drain in the center. Nate's parents scrimped for years to put a down payment on their first home, a 900-square-foot brown-carpeted bungalow in